Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 136 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. One of the great things about 2021 drawing to a close is that we can take a moment to think about all of the really amazing books we've read over the past 12 months. In order to do justice to this podcast, I'm usually reading at least one medieval book each week and bringing you only the best, which just goes to show how much incredible scholarship there is out there. Added to that, a huge number of wonderful authors have put out new books this year, so my list just keeps getting longer. It's a pretty awesome problem to have, actually. This week, I invited Peter Konieczny as the editor of both Medievalist.net and the editor of Medieval Warfare magazine to join me to talk about five of our favorite books of the last year. That's five each, and we still had trouble narrowing it down. They run the gamut from relatively obscure to New York Times bestsellers, and there's something for everyone on the list. So without further ado, here are 10 of the best books on the medieval world from 2021. Well, welcome back, Peter. It is time. This is one of the best times of the year where we get to talk about our favorite books that have come out this year. Are you excited?
I am excited. I always get, so what are we going to talk about? Yeah, books.
Yeah, books. I don't know if everyone knows that you were a librarian in a former life. You still have the heart of a librarian. So this might be your favorite podcast of the year, too.
I do. And I'm much as a librarian that I actually put my books in Library of Congress classification on my shelves.
It's true. But I mean, he can find everything. And I have my books arranged by like topic and by friends, which just speaks to the differences between us. But that's okay, because that means that we have picked totally different books to talk about as our favorites of the year. And we've each picked five books. So Peter, what do you look for in a book? What makes a good book to you?
For this list, part of it is how much of an influence will this book have on medievalists, on the field, and on just the general public? What will be remembered in like the next 10, 20 years? So I have a bit of on that, but I'm also looking for like a kind of a good story, like just well-written books. So in my case, a couple are actually primary sources that I felt were really good reads, especially for this day and age. And just ones that kind of tell me something, not necessarily new, but at least help me understand, like, do I learn anything from it? That's kind of my definitions here.
Yeah, we're kind of on the same page there. So I'm looking for, when I find out if a book is good or I think about whether a book is good, I'm looking for, again, does it teach me something, like you're saying, Peter, teach me to think in a different way, or I'll learn something new completely. But I realized as I was coming up with my list that I also come at it from a writer's perspective. So when I'm looking for good writing, what I'm looking for is like a really tight book so that everything leads to something else and everything reflects back on something else, so that the writing is really solid and tight, brings you along with the story or the book. So those are the things that I'm looking for. Does it make me think differently, or does it make me think in general? And is it good writing in that it's engaging to me and hopefully engaging to other people and gets them interested in the Middle Ages? So that's what I'm looking for in my books.
I often now these days just grab books for little bits of information. So sometimes I have that encyclopedic mind of like, oh, this is going to be useful for me.
Yeah. And if a book is on this list, I have read it cover to cover because I've just been that interested in it. So that is how it works for me. Okay, Peter, you go first. This is no particular order, I think, right? We haven't ranked these.
I've got a bit of a ranking. Well, at least my first book is one, in part because I've read it twice now.
Oh, okay.
I've really enjoyed it. And I think, to me, it's my book of the year. You had one.
Okay, so start with that. What's your book of the year?
It's called The Tale of Princess Fatima, Warrior Woman, the Arabic Epic of Dhat al-Hima. And it's from Penguin. It's a Penguin classic. It just came out this year. It's translated by Melanie Magido. And yeah, this is a super fun tale, kind of an epic, dates from the 13th century. And it's basically a story of this woman that grows up in Yemen and becomes this warrior queen, essentially. And it's kind of loosely set 8th, 9th, 10th century. It's what we have in this thin volume is just a few of the tales, because apparently the Arabic original is like something like 7 books. If you read it an hour a day, it takes like a year and a half to do. But it's a whole bunch of tales, and it's kind of roughly from the 13th century. And it's this family epic where kind of centering around this lady. Her name's Fatima. She's born in this tribe in Yemen. Her father doesn't want her. He was expecting a boy. And I don't want to have anything to do with her. Her mother secretly still wants to take care of her, but she's kind of given to this servant to raise. But by the time she's six, she's captured by like another tribe. But she knows she's special. You know, I'm not going to be your servant. I'm a lady. I'm a noble woman. And this is like six-year-old talking.
A woman who knows her worth. I love it.
Just to give you a little flavor, her captives are kind of nice to her. Basically, she's put in charge of herding camels and horses. It says, Fatima kept to herself, riding the horses and learning the arts of war on her own. Attack and retreat, lining up for battle, pursuit and defense, and charging. She made weapons from tree branches, leaves, and reeds. Whenever a camel stallion opposed her, she would shout at him, clinging at the stallion's mate until he surrendered. So everyone was really impressed by her, right? So by the time she's a teenager, she starts going on adventures in part because like there's a lot of men that want to marry her. She rebuffs them. One, she just basically kills them. So she has to go on a life of attacking other tribes to pay off debts. And eventually winds up, she's attacking her father.
Well, I mean, fair enough.
It seems this is a bit of a common motif in Arabic epics. She winds up defeating and capturing her father. The servant that was growing up tells her the truth about her parentage. So she frees her father, basically almost becomes the leader of the tribe, very much so. Then the tribe gets summoned to Baghdad. They've heard about how good a fighter this tribe is and how she is. And they want to have her go fight on the Byzantine wars on the frontier. So this tale kind of moves over to there. It is really, really, really interesting. This interesting ways it plays with gender and race as well. She is fighting against other women leaders, where it's like the daughter of the king. She'll lead the army and they'll fight it out. One-on-one duels. Meanwhile, there's men that want to marry both of them. A bit of comedy, too, where they're kind of joking around with each other. And then the stakes keep getting raised up and up. They're fighting against this king, and then they're fighting against the Byzantine emperor himself. And
you're so into this book. People can't see that you are actually waving the book around talking about it.
Another really interesting aspect, she has a son who is, although neither herself or the father are African, he is African, and he becomes a leader as well. So it's something I think that people will want to read just in the same way that people like to read these Norse epics, like Egil Saga, or even like the chivalric romances. It's very much there. I'm glad we have this translation to look at.
I think that people will read it for sure, especially with this endorsement.
I literally think this would be like, if you're looking for a new primary source to get people interested in Middle Ages in your classes, you really should consider this book. It really has a nice, interesting mix of societal commentary, fun medieval stuff, medieval warfare stuff, and different kind of things that you say you couldn't get in, say, the Song of Roland.
Yeah, exactly. And this is why I love reading primary sources, although I don't have any on my list. So I'm glad that you have this one because it sounds like one that people are going to love. So it's a Penguin classic. Great.
Part of the Penguin classics, one of their new editions.
Yeah, it should be easy to get hold of if it's a Penguin classic. So awesome. Well, obviously you've sold that one. It's your favorite book of the year.
I don't know if you have a book of the year, but it was there one of your favorites that you enjoyed the most reading?
No, I don't have a book of the year because I really love all of these. I can't pick a book of the year. They're all super good. But you mentioned The Classroom, so I'm going to seg from there and go into the one that I think is probably the most academic or the one that will probably find its home in the classroom more. And that is one that was featured on the podcast. All of these were featured on the podcast, so people can go and listen to me speaking with the authors about all of these ones. Because if I like a book, then I'll feature it on the podcast, so it makes sense. But this one is John Trevisa's Information Age, Knowledge in the Pursuit of Literature, circa 1400 by Emily Steiner. And I just spoke with her on the podcast about this one. And it's one of these books that I want to give some oxygen to, because I think that people might overlook it, perhaps, because it's about compendia, so medieval encyclopedias. She talks about things like indexes and table of contents and how these things are brought together. And I think people might think that's dry, but it's actually a really great book. It's so insightful. And one of the things that I really like about it is Emily gets at all of these questions that are super important. So she's one of these scholars. And it reminds me of Jamie Kreiner, who was on last year talking about legions of pigs. Actually, that was earlier this year, but I picked her book as one of my picks for last year, because Emily's asking all these questions, like what makes an encyclopedia or a compendia? What makes it what it is? How do you write it? What do you choose to go in there? What's the whole point of this? And so when you ask these questions, it gives you these lines of inquiry that you can follow. And so it's interesting to me, because maybe I didn't think to ask this question. She asked questions like, what is an index for? And we talked about this a little on the podcast. What's an index for? Well, it could be for just finding information, but Trevisa's index is all about getting you interested in what he's talking about in the rest of the book. But all of these things are not a given, right? Somebody has to come up with this idea and then turn it into a book or something like that. And so Emily's really so insightful in the book. And I think it will teach other scholars how to be insightful about the things that they're reading and how to ask questions about that and how to really dig into it and find out what's interesting about these books. Because compendia, or like compilations, kind of encyclopedias. I use encyclopedias because it's a more familiar word, but they wouldn't have used it at the time. These were some of the books that people were most interested in the Middle Ages. They're some of the most copied and distributed books. So it's great to have a scholar like Emily really dig into these and talk about why they're interesting then and why they're interesting now. So even though I think this one might have the smallest audience of all the books on my list, I really just enjoyed the heck out of this book. It's really a good one for people who are interested in the Middle Ages in general, but who are scholars perhaps and want to learn how to be better scholars. I think this book will show the way too.
I just heard the podcast. So yeah, it was really fascinating. I've always been one to look at those kind of questions that medieval scientists, medieval thinkers kind of proceed, like how does weather work, or how does this happen, or how long does it travel? And I was really fascinated with the idea of these indexes. And if I do a book, I want to have like an index like that, right?
Full of punchlines instead of famous people. But I mean, when you think about it, someone like Trevisa, who's a translator, who's taking stuff out of Latin and putting it into English, has to think about how do I reach my audience? So where is my audience now with their thought process or the things they're interested in? And how do I reach them? And perhaps that's one of the reasons this book really speaks to me, is that this is a question I have to ask myself all the time, right? As a historian, I think many of us as historians, especially in the public eye, have to ask that question, like, what are people interested in? And how do I communicate this with them in a way that makes sense to them? And to see this examination of how it was done in the 14th century is really interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know, as a librarian, I'm always fascinated by information and how people process and collect it. And I'm actually very looking forward to picking up that book as well.
So. Yes, I'll have to loan it to you. Okay, so what's second on your list? I don't know if this is ranked second, but what's next on your list?
Yeah, what's next is Nicholas Orme has just put out a new book. It's called Going to Church in Medieval England.
I love Nicholas Orme. He's so good. Medieval Children is one of my favorite books.
That's right. Like Medieval Children is a book a lot of medieval historians have. Also, he's done medieval schools. He's been retired for like 20 years. So I like how he's taking a look. I'm going to do kind of works to help explain the medieval world to a lot of people. And I kind of felt like this is a topic that I don't know a lot about, because I don't do too much with the Catholic Church these days. How a mass is done and all of the aspects of that. It's something I think a lot of, say, medievalists are lacking, just because, you know, we're just not involved in the day-to-day aspects of the Catholic or Christian church. So this is one where he's kind of trying to lay out how it works on a parish level, right? Like, how does your local church run? It's like, who's involved? Who gets to select who becomes the priest? How do we get like something like a choir? How does that come about? You know, what's the security? Like, how does the church, does it get closed up at nighttime? All these little aspects of medieval daily life within that local parish. And what really kind of surprised me was how much it changes throughout the Middle Ages. And it shouldn't surprise me too much, right? Like it's a big, you know, 1,000 year period. The church of the 8th century is very, very different from the church of the 14th or 15th. But as with medieval children, I think it's one of those books that you will want to kind of have as a reference guide to, hey, this explains things to me. What's the process of, let's say, a baptism? Because he does have a chapter of the life cycle. How does this church reflect when they do baptisms or marriages or funerals, things like that? I really like just reading into it and kind of learning these little aspects of what happens day to day.
Yeah, he's so good with that. It's so clear the way he writes. This book is on its way to me and I can't wait to read it. It's going to be so good. But again, that clarity, it's not easy to achieve, I think, where you can explain things in a short way that everyone can understand. And I think, as you say, it's really important to have books that are not exactly beginner books, as in they're not pitched at grade six students, perhaps, but books that get at questions like, what is it like on the everyday level? Because these are things that might be hard to find otherwise, unless you put them into one collected book like he's done.
I always feel like, and I've said this before, there's two ways to do history. Is one is you look at a bunch of different sources and you kind of put together and you kind of use it to piece something together. And the other, which I'll be talking about in my next book, is where you look at one source and you mine it for all its information. Mm-hmm. So I really admire that kind of work where you have to go through like a vast amount of different records. You know, I could see this taking so many years just to write. Mm-hmm. It's such a complex work, but it's well worth it. And thanks, Nicholas, for doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I cannot wait to read it. Okay, we need to move on. So my second book is a bit of a cheat because it came out in hardcover last year, but it's just come out in paperback in North America, and that is The Light Ages by Seb Falk. It's the surprising story of medieval science. And this is just a great book. I love this book on so many levels. The first one perhaps being that it explains these day-to-day things about how people thought about science, about how they applied technology to their lives, about the role of the church in this. And that's something that is commonly misunderstood. But Seb comes at it in a way that is just so gentle. And this is important, I think, because he's doing a lot of work here to counteract these narratives of this being a period that's anti-science. This is why he calls it the Light Ages, where people are against knowledge or against technology. So he's doing a lot of work that's kind of refuting these common narratives, but he's doing it in a way that is non-judgmental. So he's like, if you're coming at this book and you've been taught all these things in school about what the Middle Ages is supposed to be like, here's what it was really like, but he doesn't judge you, you know, no matter where you come from on the topic. But he also explains things that are really complex. And I didn't understand them before, so now I can understand them better. I mean, he really gets in depth into astronomy, especially. He loves astrolabes, but he comes at it with such enthusiasm and such, like I said, gentleness that you really feel drawn into it and you really understand it afterwards in a way that feels good, feels uplifting. So not only do you learn something, but you feel like I learned something in a way that was collaborative, perhaps, you know, it didn't feel like you were being talked down to in any way. So it's a fabulous book. And I think everybody should read it in hardcover or paperback because it's just a really good book.
Oh, yeah, this would definitely be high up on my list as well. I heard the podcast and I heard him talking like other podcasts. This is a book I really want to have because of the way he kind of lays out the talk with a kind of a semi-fictional character.
There's a historical character that you follow along to get access into medieval science. Yeah.
And I felt that was a really good way of doing the work. And it's very important to kind of talk about science and how medieval people learn and what they understood the world to be. So I quite enjoyed it. So yeah, that's definitely another book that's really going to be well used over the next few decades.
Yeah. And I think it's a good book for people who are already in the field and for people who are just interested in the Middle Ages in general. When you have a topic like this, you want to be introduced to it by somebody who just loves the heck out of this topic, like adores this topic. And Seb is that person. So yeah, The Light Ages, love that book and everyone should read it. Okay, Peter, what have you got as your third choice?
So my other version of history is where you mine a particular source. And this was done by Nicole Archambault. And her first book is called Souls Under Siege, Stories of War, Plague, and Confession in 14th Century Provence. So Nicole is basically looking at the canonization inquest of the Countess Delphine de Puymaichel in 1363, about 3 years after she has died. So they're basically looking to see if she qualifies to be a saint. And so they have this kind of inquest, bring in like 68 witnesses to give details about her life. Some are nobles, some are like merchants, some are servants of hers or like friends, and they each tell their tale. And so she's kind of taking a look at what do these people are saying, not necessarily about her, but about the kind of events that are taking place that she's involved in. And this includes stuff like 100 Years' War. There's mercenaries that are coming into Provence. There's things she has to deal with where she basically, at one point, convinces this mercenary commander to lay down his arms and be a penitential. The Black Death happens during this time. So we have plagues that kind of sweep through Provence a couple of occasions. Also, the kind of political events, which is because Provence at this time is part of the Kingdom of Naples. Royal politics aplenty. I just kind of felt this is a wonderful way of doing history where, you know, you are trying to understand what these people are saying about their world and how they're trying to deal with, in some cases, very dangerous events, right? Like this life and death struggles they're having and what it means to be with this person that they consider like a holy person.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I haven't read this book, but I imagine the type of testimony you'd hear in an inquest like this would be things like, what stories are people telling that are meant to convince you this person's supposed to be a saint? And that's another additional flavor, not just, you know, the history, which is so interesting on its own, but also the motives behind what people are saying and the way that they're framing their stories. It's got to be really interesting.
Indeed, like there's the whole aspect that we're having this trial is not the right word. It's more like, yeah, like an inquest. And the people that are running an inquest, they do want her to be sainted, all the witnesses. And so they're conveying the tale and like, what are they leaving in? What are they leaving out in this? And it's a fairly extensive document. So it really was something that Nicole could just examine. So I thought that was really good.
Yeah, medieval people are nothing if not thorough sometimes when they're testifying, when they're recording stuff, when it's important. So yeah, it's great to see a source like that where you can really dig so far into it. That sounds amazing. I'm going to have to borrow that one from you.
You can get Nicole on the podcast. That would be really awesome.
Well, we'll have to see about that. So my third book, because we need to keep things rolling, is another amazing one. Speaking of France, this is by a French scholar, Marie Favreau, and this is The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World. I spoke with her in the early part of the year, and this was just a fantastic book because I think that there's not a lot of Mongol scholarship so far that is really reaching out to a public in the English language. So I think that people will talk about the Mongols and say, then there were the Mongols, they're pretty crazy, and then just move on. So it's good to have a book in English that really digs into, and I'm saying this a lot, but I appreciate books and authors that dig into a subject, speaks about the Horde and, well, how they changed the world. So what is important to them culturally, and how does that affect their behavior? So what I mean by this is the Mongols are often painted as being like completely savage, and all they do is decimate the countryside, everybody gets wiped out and they just take over. And they're like a swarm of locusts or something like that. Obviously, this is a much more subtle investigation of what they were like. And to be fair, it's only talking about the Golden Horde, so not all of the Mongols at once. But still, what Marie gets at is things like what their spiritual ideas about the world are, how that influences the people that they take over, how that influences how they govern them. For example, they don't have the same ideas about land ownership as the people that they conquer, but they sometimes allow the people that they conquer to have their old rules in place. And I think that is something that maybe the ordinary person on the street would not imagine the Mongols would do, be that kind of sensitive or accommodating, maybe sensitive is the wrong word, accommodating of other people's cultures while still ruling them. And also she talks about their nomadic society and how the fact that they're nomads informs everything about them culturally and how that works with cities too. So I don't know all that much about nomads, so this was a learning experience for me, and especially how it works with cities, right? Sometimes they had cities that they would go to and then they would leave because they were on their usual rotation through their lands. But things like that, I didn't know about. So Marie gets so much Mongol history in this book in a way that's accessible to everybody and just meets the Mongols where they are in this case, understanding them culturally so that she can explain that cultural difference to us so that maybe we can understand their interaction with Europeans better and understand that it's not that black and white picture of the Mongols being savage that we often hear in media. So this is an eye-opening book that I think people should read in general so that they understand the Mongols better, because I think that we tend to do them a disservice whenever people talk about the Mongols in society today.
I've often done research on the Mongols, so I'm always open for like these kind of books that give you an aspect of what it was like to be living in this empire where you have your own kind of life, and then you have to deal with these others. The Mongols are after, like, oh, we have to deal with the Rus or, you know, Eastern Europeans, but ruling them, and they have to find ways to accommodate and cooperate with these other peoples. And the Mongols are very good at that.
Yeah.
Like, I've never seen like an empire that was so willing to allow others to kind of rule and deal with local challenges. Because in part, like, Mongols were very interested in keeping the trade going. So yep. A book like this is a really good way to open up people's eyes to how the Mongols interact with Europe.
Yeah, exactly. And to understand how they interact with the peoples that they conquer or the peoples that they don't conquer, you need to understand them culturally. And this is what Marie's looking at, is how does their culture affect how they interact with everybody? And I think that, again, how many books about the Mongols in English give us this perspective, this cultural perspective? There's a lot of works that you might be able to access as a scholar, but as a normal person on the street, this is a good book that you can read.
Very true. And a lot of the books that the general public can see are very focused on Mongol leaders and warfare.
Yeah.
Chinggis Khan, we'll have Baron Kublai, and we'll have their conquest. And that's literally all there will be.
Yeah.
So it's good to have something that's broader than that.
Yes, and looks at these people as human beings and not, you know, the boogeyman. I think it's an important book. Okay, what's your fourth book on the list?
So it is another primary source. It's called A Physician on the Nile, A Description of Egypt in the Journal of Famine Years. It's translated by Tim McIntosh Smith, and it is an account by a physician named Abid al-Latif Baghdadi in the early 13th century. So this copy is probably written around the year 1204. The first part is this kind of standard description of Egypt. He's basically this physician that winds up working for the Ayyubids, and he goes to Cairo, and he's living the good life, right? So he wants to write this kind of, hey, this is how Cairo is, and the animals around here, and things like that. So the first part is that. Then the second part is, this horrible famine hits Egypt in the year 1200, goes to 1200 to 1202. And he's kind of like, I have to record what's happening. And he does it in a very clinical way, but it's such a gut-wrenching read. So I don't know if I would recommend many people read this, but I kind of felt in this era of the COVID and pandemics, I wanted to kind of have an understanding of how it was in past societies dealt with tragedies. And it's really, really a tough read. If you want, I can give you a little bit of the flavor.
Sure.
So he goes, later we went into old Fustat, which is old Cairo, and saw streets and great marketplaces that had formerly been choked by throngs of people. All were now empty, but not a living creature in them, save the occasional wayfarer flitting by. Passing through these places, one felt utterly alone, even though there were a few spots without a corpse or some scattered bones. The same scenes continued until we emerged at a place called the Pharaoh's Pit. Here we saw every single bit of ground chock full of bodies and dismembered remains. The dead had taken over the hillocks hereabouts so completely that it covered every spot, and almost exceedingly in quantity, the dust of those hummocks. When we looked out into the area itself, an enormous depression in the ground, we saw skulls, white, black, dark brown, stacked on top of each other in layers. So numerous were they, and piled so high, that they had completely hid all the other bones, and might have been with heads without bodies. To an onlooker, they resembled a newly cropped of watermelons, heaped together at the harvest. I saw them again some days later, when the sun had scorched the flesh off them and they turned white. This time they seemed to me like ostrich eggs piled up.
Wow.
Like, oof. He's a very analytical writer. He's like, I'm a physician. I'm going to look at this. But he lets in stories of cannibalism. In some cases, it seems like he's like his friends saying, like, this happened to me. And just this kind of despair. And it's odd. Like, he even uses the situation where he wants to figure out something that he felt was wrong in, like, Galen, the ancient textbooks of medicine about a jawbone. So he's, well, you know, me and my colleagues, we went through like 2,000 jawbones. And it's like that kind of scientific physician's tale, but still just, it's a tough read. It's from New York University Press, part of their Library of Arabic Literature series, which is like, I seem I'm getting a lot of those books. I love them. I recommend it and not recommend it at the same time.
Yeah, well, that's important. We should only read those things that we can deal with in times like these. But I think it's really important to have those sources available, because it's important to not only understand that bad things happened, but understand how people got through it. That's one of the things I'm most interested in, as well as you are, in how people actually dealt with trauma. And I think that even that short passage gives you some of that, where he's got some reflections that are disturbing, but also what you're talking about, being able to analyze it from a distance, you know, this distancing is something that people have done always in the face of trauma. So it's interesting. But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Maybe save it until your mental health is at peak before you read it.
Don't read it in all in one go, for sure. I think you want to take some time. And at least there's that first part where it's very nice. Egypt seems like a nice place to live otherwise.
Yeah. Maybe wait till spring when the sun starts coming out for longer. All right. So my fourth book actually stays in Africa, and it is Medieval Ethiopian Kingship, Craft, and Diplomacy. And this is the one by Verena Krebs. And she is amazing, too, in that she's getting at Ethiopian kingship. So this is cool because, again, it's not like we didn't know that Ethiopia existed or that people didn't go there or came from there. But how often do we get to look at it in depth? So this is a cool book. She recognizes that she can't talk about all of Ethiopia over all time or even all the Middle Ages. So she's narrowed the scope down to kingship, because this is the core of the missions that are going back and forth to and from Ethiopia at this time. And they're so revealing of the culture of Ethiopia, what they thought of themselves as not a nation, because people didn't have ideas of nation, but as a kingdom at the time. So what's our identity as a kingdom? What's important to us? And is it worth talking to these Europeans about? Or, you know, how do we deal with this? So Ethiopia is a Christian kingdom in Africa. Their neighbors are Egypt. It's Muslim. And so there are all sorts of really cool interactions that Verena gets out here, where the Christians of Europe are saying, hey, Ethiopia, you seem cool and rich. Can you help us fight the Muslims? And, you know, Ethiopia's like, why would we do that? They're our neighbors. But hey, people from Spain, can you send us some relics? Because we want to build our identity as a Christian kingdom. So this is just a fascinating look at Ethiopia as a kingdom, as an identity of the kings. What are they looking to present themselves to be to the world? And it really unpacks and sometimes reverses what the common narrative has been about their interactions with Europe. So there's a very important moment where people say that Ethiopia is contacting Spain because they want weapons or something like that. But this is actually backwards, where Spain is asking Ethiopia for help. And so this type of scholarship, again, is really important, because we may not encounter Ethiopia all that much in scholarship, especially public scholarship. So it's super important to have a scholar like Verena, who's so smart and so detail-oriented, that you can get this really good picture of what Ethiopia was like at the end of the Middle Ages, which is what she's dealing with for the most part. But this is a really enlightening book, and a book that I think will change people's perceptions of what Ethiopia was like, what contact was like between them and the Europeans that, you know, you might hear of from the other side, from the European side. It's just a really great book that I think is going to change things for us. And that's super exciting, I think.
Yeah, I see it as part of a new kind of scholarship that's looking at Ethiopia and presenting it as a part of the medieval world from the inside out, as opposed to lots of the books we, you know, say 20, 30, 40 years ago would deal with Ethiopia. So, oh, this was one of the places where the legendary oppressor John was from.
Yeah.
And so, and we don't know too much about it. There was exploration and that was it. So it's just this odd other place that was just looked upon as, what did medieval Europeans think of it? But
yeah,
we really should, you know, understand like what people in Ethiopia understood about the medieval world around them.
Yeah. So looking out through the eyes of Ethiopia instead of all these European eyes looking into it, yeah, there's a huge difference between how they perceive themselves and how Europeans perceive them. So yeah, it's a really great book. And again, it's important that it's available to us in English, because I think that perhaps many of the misconceptions continued to grow because we didn't perhaps have these sources available to us in English. And so this is important work. And I'm so glad you came out with this book. And it's out from an academic press, so it's harder to get hold of. But if you can, it's a really good book.
And hopefully Rena will be working with us a little bit in 2022 on medievalist.net. So stay tuned for that.
Yes. Okay. Fifth book, coming to the end of our list. What's your fifth book?
Oh, yes, yes. A friend of the podcast, a friend of medievalist.net, Eleanor Yanaga.
Has done... Eleanor, woo!
She has done a book called The Middle Ages, A Graphic History. It's with Neil Maxwell Emanuel, who is the artist. And it is a graphic book, not quite a comic book, but one that is full of illustrations and just a general guide to the Middle Ages. Eleanor is a very good writer, and she's very good at picking the topics, but it's one of those books that I see should be in a lot of public libraries as a way to get people interested in the medieval world and to give them that kind of way of seeing visually to explain things. So a little bit of humor, a bit of just covering different kinds of weird topics and stuff like that as well, but giving you a nice little backgrounder. If you wanted to get something that gets someone started in the Middle Ages, this would be a very good pick to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. Eleanor is nothing if not personality, and that is why she has so many followers who just love her, and it just really shines through in this book. And she's even in the book as a cartoon, which I love. But she comes at the Middle Ages from a really personal perspective, and this is not to discount her scholarship. She's a great scholar, but she really feels this time. And so when she talks about it, you really feel this time. So she has an emotional connection to it, which makes her scholarship even better and makes it connect with people better. And I think as a public historian, you can't ask for more than the way she brings history to the people. So yeah, this is a definite choice. And we actually argued about who was going to have on their list.
Indeed.
You won.
I wanted to kind of pick it up and just look at it for like 10, 20 minutes, just enjoy how she writes and just the imagery. And a lot of this stuff I already know. If you're a medieval historian, you're like, yeah, oh yeah, this is just a quick summary of things, but it's a lovely kind of book just to have and a way to open up to people to the medieval world.
Yeah, it's not aimed at us as historians, but we can certainly enjoy it because of the jokes that are in it, the way that she gets at these parts of history that maybe not everyone knows about in her own Eleanor way. And yeah. It's a good book.
What's on your lab, your number five?
My last pick is also a history of the Middle Ages, and I went with Powers and Thrones, A New History of the Middle Ages by Dan Jones. And this is in some ways because all of the things that he's talking about in it are familiar, right? So he's talking about all the people that you've already heard of. And I think that is a major strength of this book because he's looking at them from the eyes of 2021. So most people, I think, when they come across these big figures, the books that they're reading about them are 10, 20, 30 years old. So what you know about the entire Middle Ages, it might be an old perspective on it. And in 2021, we have all of these big things on our plates right now, like climate change, pandemic, disease, political issues, and all of these things. All of those things were relevant to the Middle Ages, but you don't always see that in older histories that are sweeping epic histories of the Middle Ages. So he comes at all the familiar figures, but with the eyes of 2021. And I think that is going to bring the people to our field, and that's going to interest them. And the other reason I have it here is because Dan Jones is just an excellent writer. As a writer, looking at this, it's extremely energetic and it's very tight in that he doesn't waste words. So this book is 800 pages long, but he really thinks out what's going to go in it, how that's going to reflect back on the things he's just said, how that's going to reflect forward to the things he's about to say. It never feels like a slog. And so this type of energy, I think, is important when we're talking about sweeping history of the Middle Ages. So for people who listen to the podcast and already have an interest, but maybe don't know about the whole history, this is good. For people who are just coming to the Middle Ages as a topic of their interest, this is good. You know, if you want to reflect back on something, maybe refresh it, this is a really energetic way to do it. And we need people who are really excellent writers to be talking about the Middle Ages and bringing the people. And Dan Jones is that writer. So I like it for those two reasons. He's just an excellent craftsman when it comes to writing books, but also it's familiar and he gives it that new perspective that, I don't know, I hadn't seen in a long time. So yeah, that's my fifth one is Powers and Thrones.
Yeah, I can certainly see like Dan Jones has built up a set of several books now that have become international bestsellers. And it's easy to see why. He just writes so well and he engages people. People are kind of turning into Middle Ages for the first time and they want to learn. And you need writers that can do that.
Yeah.
Because you can't give a book from like 50 years ago.
No. And sometimes it's good to zoom out because if you are somebody who's read a lot of books about Wars with Roses, for example, which a lot of his readers have, it's important to know what their position is in the entire Middle Ages. And as he mentioned when I talked to him a couple of weeks back, you know, the Wars with the Roses, from a global perspective, it's not that big. But it's important to sometimes look at the bigger picture and that. That is what this 800-page book is doing. So, yeah, I think it's a good one.
Yeah, he's going to have a long career of doing of doing great books. And his personality is so good that he can also be on TV. He's bringing a lot more people interested into the medieval past and history. And we got to give him a lot of credit for that. He's doing a great job.
Yeah, exactly. And this is something that I've said before and we'll say again. It's a team effort. It's a team effort. We need people who are right on that front line of public history that are speaking to people who have no background, getting them interested in it in a way that is responsible. I think his scholarship itself is responsible. And then it pulls people in so that they can look at these other books that we're talking about that are really specific little bits of the Middle Ages. But you got to get the people where they are first. And he's excellent at that. I'm not worried about his career. He's fine. He's fine. Yeah. But speaking of public history, you have a couple books up your sleeve that are by people that may be familiar to readers of medievalist.net, right?
Oh, indeed. We got a lot of people on our team that do articles for us, but they do other things, including write books or like did a translation. Stephen Mulberger did a translation of something called The Chronicle of the Good Duke, Louis II of Bourbon. So this is a French nobleman, late 14th, early 15th century. It's basically an account that was written about his life a couple of decades after he dies, but it has wonderful stories of on the campaign with his men and just being this local lord and what it meant. So we have that. Kate Stevenson, who's done a few columns for us recently, she's done How to Slay a Dragon, a Fantasy Hero's Guide to the Real Middle Ages. She's actually more well known for being a big name on Reddit, Ask Historian subreddit on Reddit. So she's able to bring all these little stories, interesting things from the medieval past, kind of put a nice little book. Again, nice good read for people. And also finally, Alice Isabella Sullivan. She's like our Eastern European expert, and she co-edited a book at Brill called Byzantium and Eastern European Visual Culture in the Late Middle Ages. So it's a collection of essays she edited. She has one of her own essays in there. Great little work people are doing there.
Yeah, great work. I mean, I'm a little bit hurt that one book didn't make your list.
Oh, there is that one other book.
Come on, it's one of the best books of the year.
It is. And, you know, I'm seeing your social media and all the people sending in photos of their copy of How to Be a Monk.
Yes, my book, of course, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life. It should be on everybody's list this year, but it came out too late, so it's not on a whole lot of lists. But you know what? The reception has been really lovely from people. And I mean, I should take a second to probably explain what the book is in case you haven't heard that, although you've heard me talking about the book for weeks. This is a book that just brings together everything we know now from science about wellness and applies it to the way that medieval monks lived and just kind of compares these two and finds ways in which monastic life can speak to our lives today. So it's a book with history and science and wellness and all that stuff in it, plus beautiful pictures by Anna Lobanova. Those tiny monks are the best thing ever.
So, yeah, they are so cute. And this is like your fourth book. Mm-hmm. And literally, it is the best one. Like, it's such a unique and heartfelt kind of piece that it was just a joy to read. I'm so in awe of what you're doing, and you're just killing it.
Thanks. And I didn't even pay you to say that. Yeah, it's hard to know if this is the best book because they're like children, you know, you can't really pick a favorite, or I can't pick a favorite. But yes, people have been really showing it love on social media, even people from the clergy, which is something that is really important to me. Nuns and monks have been reaching out to me too, which is pretty cool.
I think this one for me was so much more emotional.
That's true.
That's why I think it's my favorite of the ones you've done.
Yeah, this one does have an emotional connection. It was written out of the pandemic, so there's that. But it's also, it's got all of these things that I use in my everyday life. So it's a very personal book in that a lot of the lessons in it are ones that I use on the everyday. So yeah, I can see that. It's a more emotional book than the other ones, even more than the zombie apocalypse book.
The zombie apocalypse one is the most useful book you have.
Yeah, I mean, they're all very, very different. I can't imagine the same audience, perhaps. But yeah, you got to get out there and try new things. Is there anything you want to tell us about what's on medievalist.net this week, or you just want to tell us about the books that are out?
Well, I'm letting you know, I'm just working on a piece on this 11th century army of African women who Yeah, they almost kind of disappear from history, but in one of the Spanish chronicles, there's this little section about them. And I'm just kind of going on like this research that was done about 10, 15 years ago. I just want to kind of bring out to the public a company of archers that traveled from present-day Ghana and were in northern Spain fighting battles there. Really interesting stuff. So I'm working on that.
Okay. I'm looking forward to that. I'm definitely Team Okoye from Black Panther.
And that's how I kind of put those two together. And like, we have to talk about that.
Yeah. I can't wait to read it. Well, thank you, Peter. As a librarian, your opinion carries weight on books. So it's always good to have you here, even though your books weren't in Library of Congress order. Disappointing. Thanks, Peter, for joining me.
Thanks.
Some of your favorite books may have been on the list, and since we could only choose a few, many were probably not. But if I've had a person on the podcast to talk about their work, you know it's good. You can find all the books featured on the podcast on the medievalist.net Amazon shop at amazon.com/shop/medievalists. When you buy your books through those links, a small percentage makes its way back to medievalist.net to fund the work there. So if you're doing your book shopping online through Amazon, please check it out. Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com for your support each month. We have super fun stuff for patrons like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine and the Medieval magazine, our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. And of course, there's still time to sign your favorite people up as a holiday gift. To get in on all the action, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. If you're interested in my book, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, you can still get the special discount offered by my publisher, Abbeville Press, of 20% off if you order it directly from their website. Just go to abbeville.com, look up How to Live Like a Monk, and use the code Benedict, as in Saint Benedict, to get 20% off the cover price as a special gift from me to you. We'll also have the link in the show notes. Thanks for all the love you've shown the book already. I really appreciate it. For everything from books to Beowulf, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabalski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which is out now worldwide. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.